Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another great show we have here at Suspense Radio live from Los Angeles. I'm your host, John Robb. I want to thank you all for listening live and those that will hear this on replay, because this morning we have two powerhouse best-selling authors for you, along with a debut author in this extended edition of Suspense Radio. And first up is going to be Catherine Coulter, author of 65 novels, including 59 New York Times bestsellers, working on number 60 here, talking about her latest novel, Split Second, which is the 15th in her FBI thriller series. And then we got debut author Thomas Skopel, who's going to come on, which brings his twist to the horror suspense genre with his novel, Twitch. Lastly, Alan Jacobson returns with his next Karen Bale novel, Inmate 1577. So you got to sit back, relax, because 90 minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. I want to thank everyone for waking up nice and early with us here, 8 o'clock Pacific time, to bring you this great show that we have for you. I'm also going to get in later in the show about the closing of borders and what that could mean to publishing and promotion and things like that for different authors. But now, without any further ado, I want to go ahead and I want to welcome our first guest to the show, New York Times bestselling author Catherine Coulter, to talk about her latest book, Split Second, 15th in the FBI, in her FBI thriller series. And Catherine, I want to thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thank you for having me. So this is all very exciting. It is every year because, you know, you have the it's in hardcover the first year, then a book goes into paper, and they usually publish the paperback close to the new hardcover. So it's been fun. It is fun. It's a little bit nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and that paperback is Whiplash that is out in paperback, so everyone can know. So you have both of them that just released here with Split Second that just came out on the 19th of July. So kind of tell us what Savage and Sherlock have kind of been up to and what faces them here in Split Second.
Well, Split Second. The idea came to me, you know, when you're lying in bed at night, John, and you're kind of in semi-sleep. You're not really there, but you're not totally awake.
Right.
And I said, wait a second. What if we had a bad person who was related to one of the most horrendous serial killers in the history of the United States?
And I love that idea. I love it. Yeah. I love that idea.
So that's where this book, normally I have, you know, two mysteries per book. And this one has three. It was not intended, but it just happened. And I guess the little third one is probably, I would like to know from readers if the third one, which involves Mr. Patil, if that's their favorite. we'll see, because my editor just loved Mr. Patil. Anyway, so you have that going on, tracking down this serial killer, along with the more minor mystery, which is I think it's pretty neat. And then we have another big one, which involves one of the agents in Savage's unit. She's a new character, Lucy Carlisle. And both she and Cooper McKnight, he's another agent, they're kind of in charge of this serial killer case. And then, you know, life goes on, and then something happens. And then you're plunged into all sorts of craziness. And this is basically what happens to Lucy. And I don't want to give that away.
Right.
But she finds out something that's pretty horrific and something very surprising. And then she's faced with dealing with it. So let's just leave that one kind of up in the air, because it's pretty wild.
Okay. Yeah. And we like wild. That's why we read thrillers. So now, the premise that I love is because, and I've always wondered why a thriller writer of suspense hasn't quite tried to do this, and is to bring like a real-life serial killer, put them in the fictional setting, and you kind of did that because you're using, you know, Ted Bundy as the monster, you know, the ties that, you know, this serial killer has. Now, was Ted Bundy just your first thought, or was that just is it something else is why you used Ted Bundy instead of, you know, maybe
He was the automatic thought, because he had a lot of things that I needed. For example, you know, he was up in Seattle, and then he was engaged to the woman for a while who lived in California. And, of course,
right.
I have ties in California. Lacey Sherlock's parents live here. So that worked out very, very well. I really never gave anybody else a thought because, first of all, Ted Bundy was very charming, you know, and he was at ease with people like a lizard sunning on a rock. I mean, he was very good at this. So it was automatic. It was really automatic. We were thinking,
Go ahead.
Oh, no, there was no, and you know, you wonder if he did father a child. No one knows. No one knows. Everybody assumes that he didn't. But what if he did? Well, he fathered the child, you know, while he was in prison. And I was very, very careful not to use any real names there because these people, of course, are probably under assumed names, but I didn't want to even get near that. So he has a legitimate child, daughter, as everyone knows. But what if he'd had an illegitimate daughter or son? So that's kind of, you know, that was all automatic pilot, you know, and then what happened was wild.
Now, when you're going through and you're researching something, you know, for this, and you're using Ted Bundy and everything that he did, and a little tidbit that a lot of people don't know is that I'm from Columbus, Ohio. He missed the train to come to Ohio State University and ended up going to Gainesville, Florida. Otherwise, he would have been in my hometown doing his thing, which was the largest university, and ended up going to Gainesville, Florida. Just a little tidbit if anybody knew that.
No, I didn't know that. Good heavens.
Yeah,
good heavens. Well, I'm glad he did.
Ohio State. Yeah, so, you know, we already had Dobner. We didn't need to have Bundy, you know, earlier. So, you know, we already had Tim. Ohio had her thrill. But
what a story, John.
Yeah, but and when you are researching something like that for, you know, Ted Bundy and using this in your novel, is there something that you come across always that shocked you and surprised you or scared you, or something that you just had no idea that you knew? Because with the media today, it's a lot easier to find these things out than it was back when he was doing all of his stuff because things weren't so socially networked.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing that I didn't want to know any more about, but that was all over all the research on him, and I won't go into it, but it was the necrophilia. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and there was this one, I actually used it in the book, he decapitated one person and threw their head in his current girlfriend's fireplace. You know, now that's kind of bizarre, don't you think?
just a little bizarre.
I mean, talk about being a lot of steak knives short there in the drawer. That's pretty horrendous. There was a lot of other stuff that was just, you know, you didn't want to belabor it because people know about him, and I didn't belabor it. Just every once in a while, just throw in something. Somebody would mention something, but just his name is enough to give everybody the horrors.
Oh, it gives you the willies and people shake when you hear something like that.
Yeah.
We'll
see what everybody thinks about his son or daughter, and I'm not going to tell you which it is.
Right. Well, and that's why it's genius for you to kind of do something like this, because it's kind of a groundbreaking idea. And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with Catherine Coulter. Her latest book, the 15th in her FBI thriller series, is called Split Second. We're discussing. You can find her at CatherineCoulter.com, C-O-U-L-T-E-R. And, you know, when you're thinking of, because this is book 15, and you're kind of thinking along the lines, and you're like, okay, you know, I got to kind of, you know, start doing something and raising the bar and doing something. Do you feel the pressure of that every time when you're starting to do, like, a new FBI thriller here, like Split Second?
No, but now that you brought it up, I just might, John, so thank you a lot.
You're so welcome.
No, actually, you know, I just, all I ever need or want and ask God for is a what-if idea, and then I go from there. You know, I can't do outlines because obviously I don't know what the book is about yet. So that really wasn't the what if I did for this book. This came after I'd already started the book, actually. So it's always happenstance. I find what I come up with. Occasionally, I will think, well, what if we did something? What could I do about blah blah blah? And then it either works or it doesn't. I started book 16. It'll be out next year. And before I go any further,
okay.
Let me say, everybody, after you read Split Second, either go to my Facebook page, and that's facebook.com/Catherine Coulter Books, all one word. And if you don't do it like that, I think you end up in Moscow. Or just to my website. Now, if you go to the Facebook, on the wall, you'll see a green shamrock. You just click on that, and it's the publisher sweepstakes, and the prize is really cool. It's a trip for two to San Francisco, and then I get to meet you, and we have lunch. And also, if you want to go to my website, if you're not a Facebook person, just go to my website, CatherineCoulter.com, and at the very top there's a banner, and you just click on that, and then there are 6 multiple choice questions that will not tax the brain.
And you know, and I was going to mention that because here's what's going on. You know, when you look at the publishing world and you're looking at what you have to do, because, you know, 65 novels, 59 New York Times bestsellers, you've been doing this for a long time. You've seen the publishing change tremendously, and now someone like yourself has to go out, you know, and you're into Facebook and you're doing Twitter, and, you know, you answer back people on your Facebook page when they ask you a question. I saw there was a cop that said something about, you know, like the police procedures, and you're like, please tell me what you're talking about so you can change that in the paperback, and I think that that's great. You know, is that something that, you know, you had to kind of work out because you were new to have to, you know, get yourself out there? Because it wasn't like that, you know, 15 years ago.
Well, it wasn't like that when the ARC landed, that's for sure. That's when I started writing. But actually, truth be told, you know, I've had a fan email for a very long time, readmoi@gmail.com, and I'm so used to it, 6:30 a.m., I'm a disgusting morning person. I get up, and I go to the computer, and I answer all the email, the fan email, and I do that all myself. My assistant does all the prisons and the federal, state lockups, the city, the county jail. I know them all, darling. Anyway, she does all of those, and but I do all the email. And then when I got in on Facebook, I really enjoy it. It doesn't take that long. You get instant feedback from readers, instant, just like email. And I'm about, I don't know, maybe 15 minutes in the morning. And then Twitter, since I'm not really sure what I'm doing, It doesn't take that long. I've got to learn more what to do here. Can you tell me how you tweet somebody back if they just joined you?
I have no flipping clue how the Twitter thing really works. I just kind of throw it out there, and wherever it goes, it just kind of goes. But so I'm with you on that one. Facebook, I think, is a great thing. And the Twitter.
I agree. I love to talk to people, and I can. For example, I have a little contest going right now. Everybody's give me two title suggestions for the FBI book for next year. The working title is Backfire, right now, and you would not believe I've probably gotten over 100 title suggestions. And then there's a prize for that, or sometimes I will say I need character names for, we're back in 1831 in England, and I need character names for servants, or I need character names for Cornwall. And people just jump right on it. And it's a lot of fun, and I really, really, really enjoy particularly Facebook, because you can speak, you can write a little bit more, and so it's true, this is very different. And people who are not into the technological aspects, I guess you could call them, maybe are undergoing a bit of problem. I know I have some writer friends who simply refuse to do it, and that's certainly their choice. In terms of what kind of payoff you get, I don't know. I really don't know. It's just a way to talk to people who read your books and see what's on their mind. And I'll tell you, one thing I really love about the email and the Facebook is if there's a mistake or a typo in a book, you know instantly in the hardcover.
Yes, you do.
And you immediately send it in to the errata file, we call it, and then it's corrected. So that's also a very good thing.
Yeah, fans are very good at letting you know if there's something the matter or what they think, and they have no problem in saying it. But like you said,
have any problem in saying anything.
They love telling you. And you have the Facebook. If you don't know what the payoff is, but I'll tell you what: if you don't do it, then there's nothing. And so I think it's a great thing to use it. And when you decided to go ahead and do, and this is the first time you've ever, or is this the first time you've ever offered a trip to San Francisco for someone to come out and meet you? Is that new?
Well, this is the publisher.
Okay.
This is a publisher sweepstake. I did an earlier sweepstake that's actually still going, and that has three prizes. The first one is signed 15 hardcovers to the person who wins, and then, signed audiobooks, and then signed paperback, a series. So the big one, the publisher wanted to one-up me, so they did, which is always nice. It's very interesting because you mentioned borders. They have hurt publishing very much because they didn't pay their bills.
Yes, they didn't.
And
millions of dollars.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm glad. I am just frankly glad that they have finally declared bankruptcy and they're finally closing down the stores, because of course the publishers are suing them. They had planned just to keep some of the bigger stores open that were making a little money, but they can't afford to do that. So I'm personally glad it's just come to an end. Because, then they were getting their books from Ingram, so Ingram's got to play with them, got to dance with them. So
like you mentioned off the air, we were talking, I was like, hey, the book came out on the 19th, have you heard any early returns on how it's done? And you said, well, I knew I had 20,000, at least 20,000 ebook pre-orders. I mean, 20,000.
That's Amazon, yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. And it wouldn't be like that, because then people would have to wait, to go to the bookstores. You'd have no idea, but now at least you have a sense. I mean, I think 20,000 is a great number. Before it even came out, he already had that. So,
well, it was one thing they should have known or could have told me as well were the pre-orders from Amazon on the hardcover.
Right.
But actually, I simply forgot to ask.
Yeah. But I think that you're probably seeing it like everyone else, that the e-book stuff, the electronic, is starting to overtake your basic brick and mortar sales that you used to have. that people are buying more everything online anyway. Whether it's ebook
well,
or your
sure.
hard copy,
it's instant gratification is one thing.
Yeah.
I guess the newest number on that is now ebooks are 8%, which surprises me. Well, of course, that also depends on genre, and it can go way, way up. Depending on the genre, for example, romance, mystery, thrillers is higher. It's the other genres or categories that bring that number down to 8%. But yeah, there's going to be a tipping point, John. And then what happens? Then what happens? Am I still going to have a hardcover every year? Is that going to last another 2 years before the tipping point? And they really can't afford to do the hardcover because you know there'd be no economy of scale. In other words,
the more
books you have to print, the cheaper it is and the more money they make. And so everybody's got to be very careful not to kill the golden goose, and that is the publishing industry. You know, if authors can't make a living writing, well then, excuse me, you've killed the golden goose. So it's going to be very, very difficult. And, of course, everybody wants in on it. Everybody wants to make money. And what Amazon was doing was very smart in terms of business, but they were really, really screwing with the foundations of the publishing industry as a whole, you know, underselling $10 for a brand new hardcover. And they called them loss leaders. Well, you know all this.
And they took the Walmart. They took what Walmart did and they put it on the electronic side because Walmart do the same thing. They undercut everything. They undercut their vendors and people that gave them their product. And then they went ahead and, you know, were selling their Sam's Club stuff because that's what they wanted to push a lot because that was their brand. And then that's what Amazon kind of does is they undercut and they, you know, all the publishers because, you know, they want to do their Kindles and their e-books and everything else that, you know, that they do. So they just kind of took that Walmart model and put it into the electronic form.
Well, that's a very interesting thing about that you mentioned about Walmart is I've been hearing from readers on Facebook that their Walmart seems to be phasing out books.
So I
went to Facebook Walmart, and it said, you can ask us anything, and we'll answer you. So I asked them, and, of course, I haven't gotten an answer. And I asked them, is this true what you're doing? And I haven't heard from them, so I don't. Do you know anything?
No, what I do know is that I've seen publishers talk about, I guess you know that Walmart and, you know, and Target and, you know, Costco are going to have to, you know, be more of the book providers. Well, when you go into those stores, you're getting 12 to 14 titles. That's all they have room for. They don't have room to carry a bunch of titles, so they're not going to be able to make up any of this Borders debacle, and then soon the Barnes & Noble debacle, which is going to be coming in the next, you know, year and a half. I can definitely see them closing a lot of their stores down because they're going to get bought out by the multimedia company who just wants their e-stuff. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think the next year and a half, by the end of 2012, is going to be very, very, rocky on what's going to happen and whatnot. So I just...
And
well,
plus you got the Mayan calendar kicking in.
Oh, I know, and then that's really going to screw with everybody.
And Lord knows
so,
they did not have books with the Mayan calendar back then.
No, they did not.
No, it's very, very interesting, and I kind of feel for the publishers because they come out of marketing and editors and so forth, and then you have these Harvard MBAs at places like Amazon and Sony and so forth, and they're trying to compete in terms of how to keep themselves viable. And
right.
It's on the, you know, and here now Amazon is starting their own publishing. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to watch all this. I don't know if I'd want to be starting now. It's very different and very tough, you know. For me, it's been slow, and you adapt and blah blah blah. But
Well, the thing about Amazon, they're the number one book retailer now, and so when you're talking, they want to start their own publishing. They definitely have enough juice to make it work.
Yes, they do. They do. They probably have more juice. They have more vitamin C than they need.
Yeah,
very
true. And I will say one thing. When we were at Thriller Fest, you mentioned, are you going to be in hardcover again? Well, we talked to about five different authors that used to be in hardcover, and now their latest book came out in its paperback, and they're not doing hardcover anymore. So That's another thing. So we just and it wasn't no rhyme or reason. They're not sure why, but they just took them from hardcover and put them strictly to paperback now.
So no, it's because they couldn't make the money if they did.
Yeah, so that's what happened.
I know that my print run was down this year probably 150,000 hardcover books. It was down about that many. So
The e-books will make up for all that. Don't worry about it.
Well, actually, it will. And what's so interesting, since you do get the instant gratification, they're selling more books because people can just press a button and there you got your book. So what's going to happen? I don't know, but it's a fascinating ride. I hope I get at least one more hardcover because they're so pretty.
I think that you, without a doubt, will have hardcover books. And the good
long run, John, I don't think.
Well, we'll see in the next couple, 3-4 years what happens, but I think that they're still going to be around as long as the bookstores are around. But like you mentioned, and people can go back, and you want to start with the FBI series, they can start back with The Cove and go right forward and go to your website at KatherineCulture.com. You got the books listed out in order, because some people love to read them in order.
I do, too.
You know, yeah. And so they can go back with The Cove. They can start with Split Second. They can go get Whiplash. However they want to do it, as long as they go and they read and they get the books, that's all that matters.
I agree totally.
Well, Catherine,
and please give my love
to
Shannon.
I will do that. And it has been so great to have you on. We will see you at the next conference, whether it's BoucherCon or wherever you're going to be at. Are you going to be there at BoucherCon in St. Louis?
Unsure yet.
Okay.
We'll see.
So good. And with all the heat going on there, I don't know if I'm going to go. I'm not going to get burned.
It's pretty wild. Well, next week I'm going to be in Ohio and
with
Kroger. And I think the heat wave is supposed to break and bring the temperatures down to 90. We'll see.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I'll tell you, Catherine, again, thank you so much for joining us. Catherine Culture, everybody, author of Split Second, just came out on Tuesday. So go get the book. Catherine, thanks so much, and we will talk soon when Book 16 comes out next year.
Thank you very much, John. I really had a good time.
Bye-bye. And hopefully you had a great breakfast.
Okay, I did.
Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is best-selling author Catherine Culture with her latest FBI thriller series, number 15, Split Second. One of a groundbreaking that she uses when she brings in the Ted Bundy. It's never been done kind of this way before. It's definitely one, if you've not started the series, to go out, get, read. You know, it's available wherever books are sold, and you can get it right now today. Put it on your Kindle and start reading it. You will not be disappointed. Then you'll be able to go back and learn a lot more about Savage and Sherlock, because she's done a great job starting with The Cove, going on through here. Whiplash is out in paperback. You can find out more on KatherineCulture.com. And, heck, go to her Facebook page. Answer the questions on Split Second. Go out to San Francisco. Hopefully you win. Go to San Francisco and meet her. She has that going on. So a lot of things that she does. She will answer your emails, answer your questions. You can post them on Facebook. Very interactive, very great lady. And we were just grateful to have her on. We're going to take a couple minutes here. And we're going to come back with our next guest, Thomas Scopel, and he's going to be talking about his latest book, Twitch. So in the meantime, while I go get something to drink, listen to this.
Why do I find it hard to write the next line?
everybody. Welcome back. Yes, I am an 80s junkie freak with music, and Sandu Ballet is probably one of my, you know, it's a guilty pleasure, I have to admit. But I want to bring on our next guest here, debut author. His name is Thomas Scopel. He has written a book called Twitch, and I'm going to let him explain it because it's kind of in a little different genre. So, Thomas, I want to thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, John. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, no problem. So, your book Twitch debut, it's always fascinating, always exciting to have, you know, your debut book come out.
Sure.
It's available wherever e-books are done. And it's a little different because your writing style, you know, when you wrote the Easter Peeps about the little peeps in the package for Easter, your writing style, you're going to have to explain a little bit. So tell us about Twitch and your writing style and things of that nature.
Well, Twitch is he's an idea that I had from years ago. I had went to a carnival, and every carnival seems to have a little freak show or a little freak attraction. Well, this little attraction that I was looking at was supposed to be this slug-like person. Well, actually, it looked like a piece of plastic wrapped in gauze. But the story of Twitch came to me there when people around it were talking bad about it, saying, "Oh, it's nothing," and I started thinking that people weren't compassionate about it. So this story, Twitch, I was thinking, what if this thing was alive? Would it feel bad? And then what could happen if it could get back at him? It had no arms, no legs. It really couldn't literally fight back with fists, but what if it could do it with its mind? And that's where the idea from Twitch came from.
So now, people hate, a lot of people hate clowns. Clowns scare the hell out of a lot of people. You know, they do. I mean, you go to the carnivals, I mean, they're not friendly creatures. I know that they have balloons and whatnot, but, you know, they're pretty scary. And I have to admit,
we can thank Stephen King for that.
Stephen King with Pennywise probably scared the hell out of you with the clown. But, You know, with so many different side stories when you're talking carnivals and things of that nature, you know, is that just kind of like the ideas can just kind of flow with those kinds of things? Are you just more along when you go out and you see something kind of freaky or whatnot, that kind of spurs on your thought process?
No, not necessarily. Sometimes it does. The other night I was lying in bed and I was almost asleep, and I had this idea for a tale, and I had to get up right then and there and jot it down, and I ended up writing for 2 hours.
Okay.
Most of the time, I'll be in the shower, and an idea will come to me. Well, my better half, Paula, I'll give a yell out for her, and she knows automatically, bring a Post-it note and a pen, because I'm giving you an idea to jot down, and then she'll put it on my desk, and when I'm finished with what I'm doing, then I'll run with it.
Yeah.
So ideas can come from anywhere.
And your website is thomasscopel.com.
Yeah, but I also have stayingscared.blogspot.com, too.
Okay, and it's S-C-O-P-E-L. People can find out. And you're dressed as a clown. You know,
that's my Halloween costume. It's taken me years to find one good enough to freak people out.
Yeah, well, it's scary as hell. and you've got a lot of great, you know, and you're pretty, you love the horror genre. You know,
yes.
You love the horror, everything, it looks like. So, were those the kind of books, and is there one kind of in particular that you read that kind of got you to be like, you know, I would love to be, I want to write stuff just like this?
No, as a matter of fact, I didn't start writing until the middle of 2008 when I was laid off from engineering. All throughout my life, from instructors in high school and college, they continued to tell me, you should be a writer. And I never listened to them. I took the more conservative route with engineering, thinking, oh, this will be much better. It's stable. And then I was laid off, so engineering didn't look all that good. So I jumped into writing, and I haven't quit since. What started me with horror was Chiller Theater when I was about 7 years old in out of Pittsburgh. Chilly Billy, Bill Cardell. I watched it one evening, and they had some of the old Hammer films from England, and that really it just sucked me in. And so that's where I really get my horror start from.
You know, and I'm a huge horror fan, and I would have to say that, you know, I grew up with Halloween in 78 when I was 8 years old, and, you know, Amityville Horror and then the Friday the 13th and the things like that. You know, and speaking of, and, you know, just to kind of go with the horror thing a little bit, is what do you think about today's horror stories compared to back then horror stories? You know, I think that back then they did a lot better job of scaring you with the unknown of what could be there but what might not be there. Where today,
yes.
I think it's way too gory.
Today, people are numb today. They're expecting that creature behind the door. They're expecting the blood, guts, and gore of Hollywood. Back then, it was creepy when Lon Chaney and Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing was creeping around, and you didn't know you had the black and white, and it just added to the overall effect. Well, nowadays, like I said, people, they're numb to it. They just, there's mostly, they've already seen what they're about to watch. And it's a lot of Hollywood now is rehashed over and over. Same storyline, nothing original. And I lean toward the older movies myself. The Exorcist is a movie that still terrifies me to this day. You want to get
minus
scared?
Salem's Lot
is a good one, too.
Yeah.
But sit at home at night with it pitch black and you're alone and turn your surround sound up and put in the updated version of The Exorcist with the spider walk down the stairs. Put that in and sit there and watch it by yourself and tell me you don't feel scared.
And that's the thing that you've done with Twitch is what I was trying to just kind of parlaying into is that, you know, you've been able to kind of write it back to that older style where it's more about the story than the gore of the horror part of it, which is what horror really is. It's not the gore of throwing the blood on the wall and this and that. It's the story of the deepness of the emotion that hits you that just scares the hell out of you, and
that's
what makes the horror good.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, in hindsight, I should have made Twitch a full, complete novel. It's just a novella. And seeing as I consider myself a short story writer, above all, I made it that way. Maybe it's a little longer than a short story, but I should have made it a novel. Now I'm considering telling a middle story with Twitch in it. Also, there's a couple other little things, which I'm not going to mention just yet, that I'm considering doing with Twitch. I don't want to give away the storyline all that much. I don't want to... there's a beginning and ending of Twitch in the book. I want to tell his middle ground. There is so much there.
Now, I was just handed. I wanted to know what is going on with Daily Death.
Oh, Daily Death is a funny little thing. In April, I went to my boss and I was joking with him. He knows I write horror, and I said I'm going to write your death. And he said, okay, it was a mutually agreed upon. He says, you go, pal. And so I wrote it. Next thing you know, all the employees read it, and everybody wants me to kill them. So now I have to put my stuff on hold, and every day I wrote a different daily death until I killed off everyone where I work.
Is that something you're going to put together? Are you ever going to do anything more
that? As a matter of fact, editing right now, working on some artwork, and I was thinking about just putting it together for a little bathroom book.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing like reading about death in the bathroom. Appreciate that, Thomas.
The tales alone, they're only 500 or maybe 1,000 words. So it's a quick read. It's kind of a perfect little read. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know if you can put the words "perfect little read" and "bathroom" in the same sentence. But maybe you can, and maybe you could write something where someone's reading your book, and then all of a sudden something comes out from the toilet and naps them, and then that's about it, and then that's how they died. Who knows?
Well, I have my own personal death. I'm throwing in there also.
Oh, well, that's good. At least they show how you're going to die.
Yeah. And but, yeah, it was so funny that people are so demented. On one hand, they'll talk badly about death, but then when they started reading them, they're like, "Oh, kill me, kill me, kill me! Did you kill me yet?"
I might just do it. No, if you keep talking, it might happen right now.
Yeah, I had a few people ask me, "Don't you think that you might have a copycat out there that might try some of these things?" And I tell them, if there is, so what? There's nothing I can do about it. I just write these little tales. I can't stop him from doing. If someone wants to break in your house, they're going to get in. You can't stop them. So.
Well, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with Thomas Scopel. S-C-O-P-E-L is his last name. That's his website.com. And you can find out about information. His book is called Twitch. It's a novella. And it's the old type horror, so you're not going to be getting in there reading, thinking that you're just going to see all the blood, guts, or whatnot. It's more the deeper emotional horror that kind of gets into you. So now, is there something that you're working on here in the future that's going to go along with with what you're doing with the daily death thing, or are you doing something just totally off base and something just totally different?
Well, I'm doing a little bit of everything. I'm going to work on some more daily death items, although I was considering celebrity deaths, but I don't know if I need a cease and desist letter or not. So Future Past is my full-length novel that I plan on working on as soon as I'm finished with the blog tour with Twitch. Mm-hmm. It's a sci-fi slash little bit of horror, so it's different than what I'm accustomed to. But this is a story I've had in my head for a long time also. It's a company that you can go to, and they show you what could have happened had you taken different routes in life. But you cannot change it. And it ties together Roswell, New Mexico, the Bermuda Triangle, and the government. And so far I have about 8 characters fleshed out. And they each have different repercussions for going to this company. So that's on my list. I'm hoping to have it finished by the end of the year. I've tinkered with it here within the past couple weeks, and I have most of it fleshed out, but I need to fill it.
Well, you mentioned something that, you're on this blog tour with your book Twitch, and you're doing, a lot of promotion, which is something, of course, that a debut author has never had to do. So you can kind of explain, we have some authors that listen and this and that might have never done, this types of stuff. What, how do you get involved with doing a blog tour? What are the fun things about it? What are the things that, you like doing and going out there? What's the difficult part? And, all that kind of new promotional stuff wrapped up that you never really had to do before.
Well, it's a lot of work. It's easier to write the story, I'll tell you that much. But I'm friends with a lot of writers, and they have blog sites, and they have their own websites, and sometimes it's a trade-off that they'll have me on and I'll have them on. Or I get emails, and people would like me just to come on, or they would like to interview me, or the Hot Author Report out of Australia. I received an email from them a couple weeks ago. They wanted to interview me. R.A. Evans, 7 Deadly Questions, he contacted me and wanted to interview me. So sometimes it comes out of the blue. But most of the time, you contact them or they'll contact you because you are writer friends and you've talked before. And you help one another.
Now, your book was done. Like, Twitch was finished. And so you're just waiting for it to get published and whatnot. Is that kind of the best time, that kind of lull period for when you have the book done until it goes out, that you really need to start putting your face to the grind and, your nose into the computer?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it won't hurt to stick your nose out there while you're writing it.
Right.
Put it out there to them. Get in their face. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on MySpace. I created a trailer for Twitch. I have a blog, a website. I'm just everywhere out there. I have a routine. I get up every morning. I check my emails. I work with the communications in the morning, and then I'll write a little bit, and then I'll update a blog or a website, and then I'll write some more, and then I'll go to work, and then I'll come home, and I'll write some more.
And then at what time of the day do you decide to go ahead and put this scary freaking clown costume on?
That's once a year. That's a Halloween thing. As a matter of fact, it takes 2.5 hours to put it on.
See, I think what you should do is I think you should kind of do a video. We should try to get it to where you're doing a video blog and a video thing where you're wearing the clown outfit and you're talking about Twitch, and that's what people are seeing when they see you, you know, like on a video thing promoting the book. That would be hilarious.
That's a great idea.
Great.
I never considered that. Thanks, John.
Hey,
I just might take you up on that.
Yeah. Wear the clown, talk about Twitch, because, I mean, that's just an extra part of just scary and strange, and that's what I think is just great. I think that would be just fabulous.
If last Halloween when I put it on, funny little thing, I was sitting outside this little bar called the Oyster Pub, and they have an outside area, and people were walking by. Well, all I'd do is stare at them and turn my head and watch them as they'd walk by, and you could automatically see them speed up as they're walking just to get away from it.
Wow.
Yeah, this is probably the best costume I've ever come up with. I went from a Grim Reaper to a gargoyle, and now I'm my clown, and I'm going to stick with it.
You're going to stick with the scary...
an online presence like that would... I never considered that.
Yeah, you're going to stick with the scary clown, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Clowns are great.
I'm not going to a freaking carnival again, Thomas, because you scared the hell out of me with this freaking clown.
This isn't the first time I've heard this.
Yeah, but, I mean, again, everybody, this is Thomas Scopel. Find out his book. It's Twitch. It's novella. Old-time kind of horror with the deep kind of emotional things, not all the blood and guts that are out there now, just strictly down to, you know, the basic crux of what horror is, which is scary, not bloody. That's the thing. Gore and blood does not mean horror. It actually means comedy. And when you hear a lot of people talk about today, they're like, oh, I watch those horror movies, and they make me laugh because they're just so funny, because they're just so outrageous.
And
well,
predictable.
Then it's not a horror movie. Yeah, it's not a horror movie. It's just more of a, you know, bloody comedy than all it is. But, you know, you need to get back to the old-fashioned horror. That's what I like what you've done here, is what you're doing.
Okay. Yeah. I also have a tale called The Pumpkin Patch that's coming out next month in the Norgus Press Anthology. They're very first. It's their sophomore edition. And it's little. My blurb to it is Little Johnny was an explorer, but the pumpkin patch was the last thing he ever found.
Okay, so you're not killing Linus in this one?
No, at least not yet.
Oh my God! What is it with you and holidays? The poor little peeps for Easter. Now you're killing me with the pumpkins on Halloween.
Well, the Easter piece. I had never ever read an Easter horror story.
I have never either. I hate bunnies. I hate bunnies. I'm telling you right now, I hate them. I don't like bunnies. I could care less if I ever see another bunny again. I'm not a bunny fan.
So I wrote my own. And, try searching for an Easter horror story. I searched for a month.
That.
Yeah, I don't know. It just dawned on me one day, and I was looking for it, couldn't find one, so I just wrote my own.
And people can read the story, The Horrors of Easter, in the April edition of Suspense Magazine. And so that's something that they can read because it is whole. You know, there's also, you have a lot of good humor and stuff in there, too. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It just wraps it up all together, and people will find themselves scared and then laughing 3 seconds later.
Yeah, I'm gonna drag you through an emotional turmoil, I guess.
And that's a good thing.
And then in May's edition, May's edition. Don't forget the fingers, the guide to the perfect zombie family picnics in the May edition of Suspense Magazine. Also, that's just a humor little piece. I was picturing a zombie family going on a picnic and some of the problems that they would have. And I wrote that piece in a matter of, probably 2 hours, but I laughed the whole time I wrote it.
Jiminy Louise. See, that's how some people's minds work. I never would have thought of a zombie family going on a picnic and what could possibly hurt their great outing.
Oh, I'm working on one zombie night at the theater.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
this is the great thing. This is what we love. This is why, you know... This is why we read. This is why we write. So, well, I'll tell you what, Thomas. I want to thank you so much for joining us and coming on. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be here.
And you know, and again, when do you think that your next book is going to be coming out?
Well, I'm hoping by the end of the year. I've tinkered with it for the past couple weeks. This week is my final week of the blog tour. And then I'm going to buckle down real hard and get on to it.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping by the
end of the year. Now, I have a couple little short pieces I might get out in between also.
Okay. And you update everybody on your website and Facebook and things on, you know, where they can read those short stories and magazines or if you
decide to scroll out on
your blog. Yeah. And that's great. All right. Well, Thomas, I want to thank you so much for coming on, and we will talk with you later.
All right. Thank you, John.
All right. You have a good one.
Okay. I'll see you.
All right. Bye. So, again, everybody, that is debut author Thomas Scopel, S-C-O-P-E-L, with his latest novella called Twitch. You can find him at thomasscopel.com. He's on Facebook. He's on Twitter, MySpace. He's all over to find a lot more information out about. You can buy the book Twitch wherever ebooks are sold. It's a great read. You know, it's nothing long and just a great novella to come out. You can kind of get a little bit inside his mind, which is scary, especially when you go on his website and you see the clown. And I'm just telling you, you have to invite you to go visit the website just to see the clown. If nothing else, and you just want to check it out, go see the clown, and then you're going to go buy the book Twitch because you're going to want to know what is inside this man's head, and that's the most fascinating part. Well, Alan Jacobson is going to be coming up next. But first, like I said, I wanted to get a little bit into the border situation, which was going on. And it was finally announced this week that Borders is going to close all 399 of their stores, which means there will be no more Borders left at all. They were the second largest bookseller, which is now going to put Books A Million up into that category with about 175 of their bookstores. How long are they going to last? We're not sure, with Barnes & Noble, of course, number one. But what the interesting thing is this has done is that the Borders closing has basically eliminated a lot of the promotional places. And I know that publishers were stopped to send authors to the, you know, there to promote and whatnot. But in a lot of towns, in a lot of small cities in, you know, rural America, you know, the Borders might have been the only place that they could go to get books besides maybe the library, which doesn't have everything. So it's eliminating people from being able to go into the bookstores and being able to kind of search around and see what's there and know what's going on. Because I will say, even though I'm a huge fan of ebooks and I'm a huge fan of the digital age and how things are progressing with publishing, is this. It is very difficult to go onto an Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com and just browse. Because it's like searching anything on Google or Yahoo or Bing or anything else. You type something in, you get a bunch of results, and a lot of them you don't even want to know. And if you go to Amazon, you get 85,000 results of trying to go on and just see what's on mystery thrillers, and you're never going to read them all. That's where it hurts some of the authors, because you're going to get lost in the shuffle now, because you're now competing with all these other authors on these mega websites, which is basically what it's become. It's just a mega superstore, you know, website that's selling, you know, everything, and it's very difficult for you to go and walk down the aisles and, you know, hold your bag or push your cart and see what's going on. And that's what the closing of borders is going to do, along with the fact that it's just hurting a lot more, you know, publishers with promotional money, marketing money. You know, they're not able to go out and, you know, like Catherine said, Catherine Coulter we had earlier, you know, her print run has gone down because of, you know, bookstores closing. They're not, you know, there's no place to send them to. So that's what's going to happen, and I just want people to go ahead and, you know, get on and, you know, follow those kinds of stories about what's going to happen, because it's going to affect you sooner or later, you know, if you're a big reader, it's going to affect you sooner or later on what, you know, what you're going to be able to go to and where you're going to be able to find your, you know, your latest book and things of that nature. So, you know, keep your eye on those things, because it is going to come into your town sooner or later. But, you know, I do suggest that if you wanted to know any information or anything else, we can answer any questions for you. If you have, want to know about an author or things that are coming up or whatnot, you know, you can, you know, visit us, suspensemagazine.com. You know, we're trying our best to get out there. We're going to change, you know, kind of how our website's looking, and that's all in progress. And things like that are coming up to try to stay more, a little bit more current on things that are going on. But, you know, you can find things out. You can email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com for all the latest and greatest of what we know about what's coming up. And, you know, we'll help you out any way that we can. Well, right now I want to welcome back one of our good friends, and his latest book is called Inmate 1577. It's the latest in his Catherine Vale novels, and I want to thank Alan Jacobson for joining us today. So, Alan, great to see you again. We just saw you a couple weeks ago in Thriller Fest, and how you doing?
I'm doing great. My new book just came out. You know, you got to be doing fantastic when that happens.
I know. You get all geared up and ready to go, and you just start. Now here comes the promotional churning thing that you're going to be doing for the month or a couple months down the road. So it's always fascinating.
Well, you know, I really love Inmate 1577, so when you love your novel, that makes it extra special. I mean, I don't know if I'm, I guess it's hard to explain, but it's almost like putting your child out into the world and watching him or her grow and watching people relate to him or her, and just, you know, it's tremendous pride. And I can't wait to hear the responses of my readers.
Well, you know, you're taking Catherine and you're setting her here in San Francisco with Alcatraz and some other, you know, prisons and things that are going on. What was kind of the basis and, you know, Inmate 1577, and, you know, tell everybody a little bit about, you know, the book and behind the scenes of it.
Well, it's a very funny novel in that I never intended to write it. Every novel that I write, I have usually an idea that hits me either years before or months before or weeks before, and I plan it, I outline it, and I live with it for a while. And I know that it's the book that I want to write because I can't stop thinking about it. So this was not like that. I was writing Velocity, which came out in October of 2010, and I knew pretty much what I was going to write next, and it had been a book that I had been wanting to write for over a year, and I had outlined it, I was excited about it, and I figured I was going to give Karen Vale a rest. I figured, you know, I've written three books with her, I want to keep her fresh, and I didn't want to, I didn't want my readers to get, you know, stale with her, so I said, I'm going to give her a rest. And then all of a sudden I had this idea, Karen Vale on Alcatraz. And it was like, wow. And I said, no, I'm going to write this other book. And I put it aside, and the next day it popped into my head again. And I started making notes. You know, that's what usually happens. I just have these ideas that explode in my head, and I have to write them down. And so I wrote down the ideas, and I put it aside. I said, someday I'm going to write this. The next day, more. I couldn't. I really, what happened was I couldn't stop thinking about it. And as I said, you know, when that happens, I got to pay attention to what my brain is telling me. And I just, it went on for days like that until finally I started writing it and I started researching it and outlining it. And I said, well, I just got to write this book. And
right.
I'm glad I did.
And the one thing, and because, like, when we met you in Thriller Fest, the one thing that we want to make sure that people know, Inmate 1577 is not about an Inmate 1570, really, that was really on Alcatraz. So I want to make sure people know that this is, you know, your fiction story with Karen Vale, and it's not about a real Inmate 77 that was, you know, 1577 that was actually in Alcatraz. It's not a true crime book.
Right. It's not true crime, although, you know, John, that with my novels, I research everything.
Yeah,
so the things that are usually fiction in my novels are the characters that I create and the stories that I tell. Now, Inmate 1577 is a little different because, for me at least, there are two tracks to it. One is set in the 1950s and early 1960s, and therefore, you know, the tie-in to Alcatraz, it's the story of this this father, this single father, who let's say that circumstances don't go his way, and then choices that he makes are perhaps poor, and he ends up in this situation that none of us want to end up in, and ultimately finds himself at Alcatraz. So that's one track, which alternates with the present day in San Francisco. Karen Vale, my character, the first female FBI profiler. So she's on the case. She's brought out to San Francisco because there's a homicide of an elderly woman, and a sexual homicide of an elderly woman. And I think everybody would agree that that's a very unusual type of murder, and it is in real life an unusual type of murder. But a very, very close friend of mine who I've now worked with on my novels for 19 years happens to be an FBI profiler, and one of his concentrations of study was the sexual homicide of elderly females. Nobody had really studied it in any kind of depth, and Agent Safrick was the one who became the worldwide expert on the sexual homicide of elderly females. So I had all this knowledge, and I had all this experience with that, and I'd never written about it. Well, here this was part of the idea that I came up with, and I jumped off with it, and I started off with the sexual homicide of an elderly female in San Francisco. Karen Vale is brought out to deal with it because Agent Safrick, who really does appear in my novels, he's mentioned a lot throughout the Karen Vale series, he's unavailable. He's out of the country doing a seminar in, I don't even know if I really mentioned it in Inmate 1577, but he really did travel all over the world speaking on not only profiling, behavioral analysis, but the sexual homicide of elderly females. So in my real life, in my book, I mimicked real life in that he's not available, so Karen Vale, who co-authored a research study on this topic, goes in his stead. And so she's off and running back in on the West Coast, which she doesn't particularly like too much because she's not had a very good time. Crush, the second novel in the Karen Vale series, was set in the Napa Valley. Velocity, the third is still in the Napa Valley and some areas in the Bay Area. And she didn't have a very good time, as you would think. You know, it's a thriller. Bad stuff has to happen. So here she is back in San Francisco, and the two storylines, the one from the 1950s and 60s, merged together with present day. And it's a very different type of story in terms of how I wrote it, and it's the reviews have been absolutely terrific. As I said, I'm just super excited about it.
Well, you know, you should have, you know, you're going to have to give Karen a little bit of a break here. Is coming up because the poor woman, you're putting her through the mill.
Yeah, she's had a tough time.
I mean, Yeah, she's going to need to go on some administrative leave here soon because you're putting her through the mill, Alan. I mean, that's just what you're doing.
Well, you know, the other thing that's odd is that I never intended to write a series character. In fact, I had said the opposite. I'm never going to write a series character. And the reason why I said that was, you know, I didn't want to get stale as a writer, and I didn't want my readers to get bored with a character that, you know, is back in every book. So I said, I'm not going to do that. I loved writing standalones with characters that were new and different, and I started with a clean slate. And that, of course, was my attitude until my publisher sat me down and said, this was when Seventh Victim was, which is the first Karen Vale novel, that was in production, and they had sent out all the advanced reader copies, and they were getting an incredible response to Karen Vale. And they sat me down and said, you need to make Karen Vale a series character. The response has been incredible. You need to do this. And, you know, of course, I was like, but, and you don't say no to your publisher. So I said, let me think about this. I have to figure out how I will do this to make her a character who is interesting and exciting from book to book. Otherwise, honestly, I did say this to them, I don't want to do it because I don't want to write a piece of garbage. And they said, okay,
right.
You know, we respect that. Think about it. Let us know. And really, I went back to my office and I thought about it. I was trying to figure out how I would do it to keep Karen Vale new and different from book to book. I didn't want to write the same killer over again with, you know, the same storyline. Just you change the character names and you write something that's the same thing. I absolutely was not interested in doing that. So I figured out how I would do that. And one of the most important things was challenging Karen Vale, taking her out of her comfort zone into new and different places, new and different situations, new and different types of killers. It's just everything different for her that she's never faced. So that's why in Crush, I brought her to the Napa Valley. She likes wine, but she doesn't know anything about it. And she's never been to Napa, and she really hasn't spent much time on the West Coast, which she's, you know, she's an East Coast person. She's got strong, sarcastic, dry wit, which does not go over well in the West Coast, which I learned because I'm
correct.
From the East Coast, and you know,
exactly.
I moved out here
from the Midwest East Coast too. Yeah, and I live in
yeah.
West Coast now, so
it's different. You know, the people.
It's different.
Yeah, so I try to capture that, and that's part of the challenge too. Is her getting along with some of the people she has to interact with, and learning that, hey, you know what, things are a little different out here. And it was tremendously challenging to her and therefore me as a writer to put her in the Napa Valley. And it was the best decision I ever made because I love Crush, and that led into Velocity. And Velocity deals with a type of killer that she's never encountered before. And it was something that even the real behavioral analysis unit had only encountered, I think, once. And it was, and even the way I wrote it was totally different from that one occurrence. So I worked with them very carefully to make sure that what I wrote was accurate in terms of how this type of thing would happen and how they would approach it and so on and so forth. And it turned out to be Velocity, at the time, my best reviewed book ever. And it was everywhere that I went on book tour, people were just, oh my God, I can't believe it. And of course, that was until Inmate 1577. And now I'm getting that response with Inmate 1577, and people are saying, no, I think this is your best book ever. So that's pretty exciting.
Well, I know that we had Velocity in the running for 2010 Book of the Year, and I believe we listed it as one of the top four best thrillers of 2010, but you were one of the final 10 total of all the genre books with Velocity to be considered the best book of 2010. So, yeah, you had to really up your game here for Inmate, 1577. And, you know, that pressure starts to mount when people start saying, well, this is your best book ever. And then you're like, oh, great. Well, if this is my best book ever, what the hell am I going to do for the next one? And you kind of feel that pressure going forward. So So, yeah, you do have that challenge of trying to keep Karen fresh and the stories fresh and putting her in situations all the time. And that's, you know, so it does make for a lot of challenge. You know, there's a lot of challenge writing standalones, but there's also a lot of challenges writing series where, you know, you've been able to do it very good in keeping her fresh, where there's a lot of authors out there, and I'm not shy in saying it, there's a lot of authors out there that don't keep their series fresh, and to me, they no longer became an author, but more of a business. And I think that's the fine line that you walk when you start writing a bunch of series. It's very difficult.
No, you're absolutely right, and that was my biggest concern. And, you know, as I said, you never really want to say no to your publisher, but I was prepared to say no.
It's your name that's going on the book, not their name. And, you know, you're the one that has to keep your name and reputation writing up there, not them. So,
exactly.
You know, it is something.
No, that is exactly what I said to them during, you know, that meeting. I said, look, you know, I don't want Alan Jacobson, that name, to be on a book that's a piece of garbage. And, you know, they kind of chuckled and said, you know, they understood that, and they didn't want to publish a piece of garbage. So we were on the same wavelength for different reasons, but you're exactly right. It's your name, it's your reputation, and your integrity as a writer, and your relationship with your readers. I have developed a very close relationship with my readers. If a reader sends me an email, unless something, you know, screwy happens where it goes to junk, which has happened.
On your 18-month book event tour that you did last year.
You know, yes, it is harder for sure when you're touring and on the road or on deadline to respond to reader email, but I do. I do it. And I have even found emails in a junk folder that are 2 years old, and I still respond and thank, you know, goodness the email is still good, but they write back and they can't believe that I bothered to write back. But that's the kind of relationship I have with my readers. And now we've got two Facebook groups. One is my official fan group, and the other one was started by fans. So I'm on both of them fairly regularly, and I interact with them. And, in fact, there is something in Inmate 1577, I can't say what it is, but it comes back to something that Karen Vale did in The Seventh Victim, because it was something that my readers felt strong about, and I took it to heart. And even though when I would explain to them why I did what I did, they go, oh, okay, we get that, and they're fine with it. But the fact that I heard it from half a dozen readers who didn't know one another, that is my signal that I need to do something to address that in some manner. And so I did in the Inmate 1577, and I had a reader already comment on it, even though the book's only been out 2 days.
Yeah.
She reads fast, and she sent me a Facebook message and picked up on that and said, wow, you know, I can't believe you did that. That was great. And I explained to her, you know, came from my relationship with my readers. I listen. I want their feedback. So it's a different time. You couldn't do that back in, you know, when I first started writing. In fact,
no.
When False Accusations, my first novel, when that came out in 1999, I was one of the first authors to ever put his email address in the back of the book on the flap copy. So I've always sought out reader contact, I guess. So anyway, that's my philosophy. Yeah.
You know why? Because you were probably one of those, you know, writers who started out a very, you know, avid reader who would love to be able to contact the author and maybe ask them certain questions, and therefore, when you decided to write, you said, I'm going to be one of those authors because I want my readers to contact me and either tell me things that, you know, might be a little off, or tell me, you know, how things could be better or how well I did or things like that. You wanted that interaction.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to, I remember writing a letter to Steve Martini because I loved his Paul Modigliani series, and I would read his novels and I would have to go write myself. I would run to the keyboard when I would be reading his novels. So I had written him a letter, not really, you know, telling him, I mean, I told him, how much I enjoyed his writing, but the gist of the letter was, I'm now writing my own novels, and I really could use some advice as to how to get an agent and move forward in getting my career started. And there was no email. I mean, this was, back at the very early stages of email, and I actually had to go. I went to a book signing of his. I bought his new novel, and I handed him the letter. That was how, it happened.
Yeah, that's all you had to do.
Now it's different. You dash off an email, and if you're an author like myself, you reply, or you go on Facebook and send them a note, and hopefully you get a reply. So it's different times.
Well, I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with best-selling author Alan Jacobson. His latest book is his Karen Vale novel, Inmate 1577. You go to alanjacobson.com to find all the information out. And I want to make sure that Alan, make sure that you put the www in front of your alanjacobson.com. Otherwise, it takes you to another website where you can't click on any of the links. So you have to go to the www. alanjacobson.com to be able to have your page interactive. Just so you know, I found that out yesterday.
There's a glitch with the website, and we're working on it. But that should be resolved.
But now here's something different, and we talked about this, when we met you at BoucherCon and then Thriller Fest again this year. But you've decided to kind of pull way back because from your book tours, because last year you basically were like a Metallica. And you were touring the country a rock star, going all over the place with your book. I mean, you were here, there, left, and right. I mean, your head was spinning. Now you've decided to pull back a little bit. What was your reasoning for pulling back so much on your book tour for Inmate 1577?
Well, for all of my novels, I've always toured that way, like you said. And I always would go into all the bookstores in a city and meet all the booksellers, talk to them, explain to them who I was, introduce my book to them, and ask them to read it. And because I felt that if they would read it, then they would enjoy it and then recommend it to their customers. But something happened around the time that we were setting up the Velocity Tour. Actually, it started happening during the Crush Tour, where the economy collapsed and all the booksellers were having financial difficulties, and they were scared because, and I've talked for 2-hour seminars on the rise of digital books and the publishing industry and the changes that have occurred over the past 20 years in publishing. Because what we're seeing today, I don't want to get too far afield. Let me finish answering your question, and then I'll go into this. But
we'll go to that one. I love that other topic too.
Okay, yeah, it's one I could literally talk for hours on, but we're not going to do that today. But so the issue was really one of critical mass. When you go on a book tour, they're very, very expensive. Publishers spend, pick a number, $10,000, $20,000. And if you think about it, you're flying all over. You're staying in hotels. You're eating, sometimes having a media escort you around, drive you around, or if not that, you have to rent cars. Just start adding it up, and you can see that every city you go to is, you're looking at well over $1,000, $2,000. It's just not cost-effective. It never was cost-effective, but it was something that was done. And if you had a successful tour, you never earned back the money that was spent, but you earned it in intangibles and exposure, and you did radio and TV interviews, and that's changed too. So what has changed today? Of course, radio and TV, they're doing more, sensational type, true, real news, hard news, and they don't want to talk about novels, by and large. So that's something that's happened really over the past 5 years, if not even a little bit more. So there are fewer interviews. Then you've got the main problem, which is there are fewer bookstores. And this has happened really, as I said, it sort of hit an ice patch when Crush was coming out, which was October of 2009. my publicist was setting up the book tour, obviously earlier than that, a few months earlier, and Barnes & Noble and Borders were in really bad shape financially, and they were scared. And, you know, the book industry's never had a good business model. It never has. And if you think about how it operates, you just wonder how they survived this long. And I know a lot of your listeners may not know, because most people don't know what really goes on behind the scenes in the book industry.
It would scare them. It would scare them to know that, too.
Right. Well, here's the issue. I mean, if you have publishers printing what used to be tens of thousands of copies of a book that they thought they were going to sell. They had no guarantees they were going to sell that. They would get orders from the bookstore chains and independent booksellers to sell a certain number of copies. Well, they didn't print that number of copies because they wanted to be able to replenish the stock quickly. Because if somebody goes into a Barnes & Noble and says, you know, I want this book by Alan Jacobson, and they go, oh, we just sold out, you know, come back in a week, you've lost that customer. So the idea is to stock it regularly so that when your stock goes down and you're selling a book and you've sold five copies, automatically you would order another five copies to the store. So that is the way it used to work. And then the bookstores, no, they don't buy the books. They take them on consignment. So if the book doesn't sell within a few weeks, they ship them back. So what you have is the publishers printing off a lot of books. They ship them to warehouses around the country that are distributors. So they're middlemen. Okay, so you've got now, well, let's keep going with this. So you got middlemen storing these books. They get orders from bookstores. They then ship the books to the bookstores. They keep them for anywhere between 3 and 6 weeks, and then the bookstores ship them back if they didn't sell, or any copies that didn't sell, they get shipped back to the warehouses, and those books then get trucked around the country again from warehouse to warehouse. So, you know, let's look at this business model for a second. You've got a lot of shipping going on. Well, what's shipping? Gasoline. And you have high gas prices. Right?
Yep.
Yeah, and then who's doing the shipping? Well, you got truckers driving it all around and hauling it from, you know, the boxes from place to place. Then you've got the middlemen, which take, guess what? Money. They take a cut for storing these books and distributing them, right? So
yeah,
the price of the book goes up, right? Because real estate's expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So then you've got the actual printing and binding of the book, which is labor intensive, which is, you know, people doing that, right? And we all know cost of labor in the U.S. has gone up. That's why a lot of things are, you know, made in China, because it's cheaper labor in India and so on and so forth. Well, we don't do that with books because they're heavy and they're big, so shipping would be even worse, or they'd have to be, you know, shipped by ship, in which case it's taking even longer. So
everything you're saying is wonderful, because this is the exact reason why we don't have a print magazine anymore. Aside from the fact that you might not know that when they do ship those books back, those bookstores, they were waiting 9 months to pay you on the sales that they had of that month. Now, that might just be for the magazines, but 9 months having to wait for your money, and you're floating the money to a bookstore who's in bankruptcy or in trouble, and you're giving them a 9-month line of credit.
Right, which you probably are not going to get paid on. If you're lucky,
yeah, so,
right?
You know,
exactly. So
the whole thing is ridiculous,
right? And that's the problem with the business model. So then you factor in, okay, so you know already it's inefficient in terms of cost. Anybody running a business would look at this if they were doing a startup, and they'd go, "No freaking way! Are you kidding me? That's a losing model." Well, publishing could get away with it for so many years because people were buying books. And books were, you know, kind of expensive, and they were making it up in volume. Well, what happened? Readership started to go down, starting years ago. You know, several years ago, the number of books that sold were diminishing. So, you know, you had people, young readers, more interested in video games and then Facebook and texting and all this stuff that was going on, and readership was diminishing. Then you had, you know, the price of books going up and people backing off and doing other things with their entertainment dollars, and you had this downward spiral. that was slow but steady. And then, boom, the economic crisis hits and people stopped reading. Now, you would think, everybody thought, oh, people are going to read because it's very inexpensive entertainment. When you look at it in terms of, you know, two of you go out to a movie, you're spending $20. You probably go out to dinner before, whatever, you know, it's expensive for those 2 hours or 3 hours with dinner.
Right.
You know, but a book could last you much longer than that for the same price or less. So everybody thought readership would go up. It did not. It fell further. Barnes & Noble started firing all its community relations managers. And I don't know the percentage, but a large percentage of the stores no longer had community relations managers. Those are the people that set up the book signings and the events. So this kind of brings us back to what I was saying. So when Crush was coming out, we were setting up the book tour, and we had my publicist had a tough time scheduling signings at the chains. They weren't setting up book signings. They were saying, well, we're not, you know, they didn't want to admit it, but this is what the story was. They weren't getting a lot of foot traffic. If you don't have foot traffic, you don't have people coming to book signings. And if you don't have events managers, you're not publicizing it, which was a big reason also why people weren't coming to the events. So, you
right.
know, it was a cycle, and one thing fed off another. And the tour for Crush was a very different tour. I was signing at different places, more independents than chains, and that's hard to do when there aren't that many independent bookstores.
There isn't. There might be one good one per big city, and that's about it, and even some of that's going away when you look at the big mystery bookstore that was just here in Los Angeles that closed down, and you figure a bookstore like that in a big city like Los Angeles would definitely have enough traffic in order to keep it going, but even that one closed.
Yep. It's, you know, the odd thing is that those independents that have survived are still here, and a chain like Borders, which was, you know, yeah, they're gone. So that is kind of a very surprising and shocking, because if, you know, 10 years ago you would have said that to somebody, they would have laughed in your face, you know, oh, yeah, right, Borders is gone and the independents are still around. That was not the trend, you know, a few years ago. It was the opposite. But, you know, even the independents are still closing. It's just, it's a tough environment out there for books. And it goes back to the same thing that I was saying in terms of the model of printing hard copies and, you know, that are heavy and big and shipping them around the country is just not sustainable. You can't charge enough money for the book to have all these factors factor in and have it be a reasonable price for the consumer. Hence, you look at the other model, the digital model, and how can you say that, you know, that's not going to, people are eating this stuff up. It's easy, it's fast, it's convenient.
And I love
traveling.
It.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I'm telling everybody right now, you know what? You go out right now, get Inmate 1577, Alan Jacobson. We have run out of time. We have just been going. We got like 2 minutes left. So Alan, you know, Inmate 1577. Want to thank you so much for coming on. Wish you nothing but the best with the book.
Thank you. It's a fun read. It is available in hardcover and of course in e-readers. You know, all the digital platforms, and that's pretty exciting. And also, one last thing. You mentioned my website. On my website, I am giving away free the personal safety booklet that I co-authored with FBI profiler Mark Safrick. It's full. It's 23 pages full of safety tips on keeping you out of the crosshairs of violent criminals. So if you either go to safetybooklet.com or alanjacobson.com, fine, put the www in front.
Yeah, put the www in front.
Good.
All right, Alan. Well, hey, thanks so much for joining us today. And, you know, of course, we always want to keep in touch on what you're doing and what's going on. So we will talk with you soon.
Thanks, John. Take care.
All right. All right. Okay, everybody. Alan Jacobson, the book, Inmate 1577. Go to alanjacobson.com. We had Catherine Coulter on talking about Split Second. Go to CatherineCoulter.com. And then Thomas Scopel with his book, Twitch. ThomasScopel.com. We will see everybody on SuspenseMagazine.com, Facebook, Twitter, wherever you can find us. Have a great day, everybody. Enjoy yourself. We will see you all in 2 weeks. God, Rob, thanks. Goodbye.